this report from Making Contacts, a project of the National Radio Project that you can frequently hear on our Sunday morning edition on WZBC. That's New U-Turn Radio from 6 to 10 a.m. Just an excerpt of that today before our report. Following the LA Times article on Wednesday detailing the U.S. military's admitting it's conducting psychological operations in the conduct of its reporting of what's going on before the attack against Fallujah. This was detailed in the report I read earlier in the program from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, just released yesterday. And to help us take a look at this story, I'm very glad to be able to welcome two guests with us right now. Joining us from England right now is Professor Christopher Simpson. He's professor of communication at American University and the author of several books, including The Science of Coercion, Universities and Empire, and War Crimes of the Dresdner Bank and Deutsche Bank. Welcome to the program, Christopher Simpson.
Thank you.
Also very glad to welcome Professor Robert Jensen of the University of Texas at Austin and author of the book Writing Dissent. Welcome, Robert Jensen.
Great to be with you, John.
Let me start out by asking you, Chris Simpson, a bit about some of the backgrounds to the United States military's involvement in psychological operations, or PSYOPs, as they're called in the intelligence jargon. What is the United States military's, what are some examples of the way that the U.S. military used PSYOPs before the recent attack on Fallujah?
Psychological operations are fundamental to U.S. military strategy and have been for a long time. If you think about the Cold War, where you had 40-some years of a so-called no-war, no-peace situation, psychological operations are built for that kind of situation. They are ways to extend military power without necessarily committing troops. When you ask what are examples, sort of name your examples. The Philippines, Chile, Iran, most definitely in Vietnam War, throughout Southeast Asia, and so on. There are different types. Some are much more violent than others. But the basics are putting across a coercive message in order to make some sort of political or military gain.
And then what happened in Fallujah, tell us about how you saw the example of the military announcing that their first takeover target would be the hospital in Fallujah.
Right, right. Well, again, to back up as far as history of this sort of thing, during the Reagan administration's battles with Libya, one of the techniques, very similar to the one we'll see in a moment in Fallujah, was to leak to the Wall Street Journal and other papers that the administration was mobilizing for war with Libya. And the idea was to provoke a coup d'etat in Libya by military folks in Libya that were presumed to be ready to overthrow the Gaddafi government. But in fact, it didn't happen, and this invasion of Libya was never planned. It was a psychological operation from word go, and it blew up in their faces. It's because the Wall Street Journal, which is very sympathetic to the Reagan administration and to the Bush administration today for much the same reason, was very much burned by this, and at least the journalists there were more skeptical and more suspicious of what the administration was up to. So, come to Fallujah, basically the same pattern. You had an Army public information officer, psychological warfare officer, essentially, leaking to CNN, this is back in October, the claim that the battle for Fallujah had either actually begun or was about to begin. Imminently at that time. And if you think back of the news coverage at that time, it did drift out into the American news coverage in about mid-October. The whole object of this was to get CNN to broadcast this news story, this planted news story, and then the rebels in Fallujah would take military responsive action. Where would they go? They would go to this and this position. They would do such and such with their weapons, such and such with the radio communications, and so on, while the Americans watched. And then, knowing what their procedures were, when the war did start, they would have preempt those. Now, it sounds like clever military tactics, and to an extent it is, but these are military tactics carried out at the expense of the people of the United States. And this is an important thing to understand about psychological warfare. While it is true that this immediate target in that example was people in Fallujah, the fundamental target, the target that keeps coming back again and again and again, are the people of the United States. They're the main ones who are being propagandized to, who are being manipulated by media organizations and by security organizations.
We're speaking with Christopher Simpson, professor of communication at American University. You're tuned to 90.3 FM. The program is Sounds of Dissent. Let me ask you, Robert Jensen, journalism professor at the University of Texas at Austin, about some of the contexts of this as far as it affects journalists and what's described as a kind of tacit agreement between the press and the Pentagon in a time of war. This was CNN's Aaron Brown reporting the story just on Wednesday, December 1st, admitting that he said, quote, "None of us are particularly comfortable when we're talking about things, about ourselves, if you will," he said. And then he said, "There's an important and explicit bargain," I'm quoting, "between the press and the Pentagon in a time of war. We don't do anything to endanger the troops or operations, and they don't lie to us. Each is essential in a free society, and each is made more complicated by the information age. But it seems that sometimes in an effort to mislead the enemy, the military has come close, very close, to crossing the line and misleading you," end quote. Again, that from CNN's Aaron Brown on Wednesday. Robert Jensen, your response.
Well, it's striking that Aaron Brown can be so either naive or corrupt that he believes the Pentagon doesn't lie. I mean, that's a laughable claim. So it shows, I think, the naivete of journalists that they actually think they're being given accurate information. I think, you know, Chris set out the sort of background of PSYOPs, and I think it raises two questions for journalists. One is that when the government, the military in this case, does knowingly lie, it makes journalists sort of an agent of the government. And a lot of journalists are uncomfortable with that. They don't like that. They see that as crossing a line, and they reject it. But, of course, the other problem that Chris, you know, identified is that those are operations aimed at learning something about the enemy or influencing the enemy. But as Chris points out, a lot of propaganda is directed exactly at the American public. Now, technically it's illegal. The government isn't supposed to propagandize its own public. But most of what we call, you know, public information, which the military does a lot of, is manipulation, propaganda. It's framing issues. It's leaving important information out. It's sometimes fudging the truth about information that is distributed. And on that, journalists are willing participants, and Aaron Brown's comments reflect that. That journalists are sort of part of that system. They see themselves as being independent, but of course they don't function in an independent fashion. So you've got two different questions. What happens when the military kind of commandeers journalism in a way that journalists don't like? That's a threat to the independence and integrity of journalists. But perhaps more importantly, what about all the cases where journalists essentially sign on for the ride? They trade access for independence. That's a different problem, and I would think a much more serious one in some ways.
Robert Jensen, could you comment about explicitly this term, just simply the word lie, to lie, lying? Of course, we can point to the humorous example of the title of Al Franken's book, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them. Yeah. He mentions it several times in the title. He was sued immediately, and then the lawsuit was thrown out of court, of course. But there is this. I mean, we talk about Aaron Brown at CNN, and I don't know whether he believes that governments do not lie, or the U.S. government or the military does not lie. What he just said, though, was that it seems that the military has come close, very close, to crossing the line and misleading you. Now, tell me about just the background, again, the backdrop against this, against which this takes place, where journalists essentially tacitly agree never to say in print, almost never to say that someone has lied, but never to say that a government official has lied. Other terms this, might be used, but go ahead.
Well, this is a great problem, of course, especially with the Bush administration. There's a couple of interesting issues here. One is that as the propaganda techniques of people in power are perfected, they do less overt lying. If you actually look at, for instance, the run-up to the Iraq War and parse the statements that Bush made, a lot of them intimated things that weren't true, but they're very sophisticated at not coming out and telling sort of straightforward lies, although, of course, there were their share of them told in the run-up to the Iraq War. So one of the things we have to realize is this sort of increasing sophistication of government propagandists, and, of course, corporate propagandists, too. There's always a private element to this in the private sector. They're doing the same thing. But, of course, the government does lie overtly, and it happens all the time during war. I mean, to even pretend it's otherwise shows you Aaron Brown and mainstream journalism's incredible complicity in all of this. You know, so the United States blows up a wedding party and says, that wasn't a wedding party. And then a few days later, there's incontrovertible evidence that it was a wedding party. And they say, well, there were terrorists hiding in the wedding party. You know, it's a constant shifting set of rationalizations, justifications. And, of course, we also have to remember it's not just what is said that is false. It's also what isn't said. The notion that the military is giving anybody a complete of what's going on in the battlefield is insane. No military is going to tell the public things that are detrimental to the military's efforts. It's just, I mean, it's stunning that Aaron Brown, who I must say is a kind of quirky person and says a lot of very odd things on the air, but this is kind of just stunning that he could say something so obviously, you know, ridiculous.
Well, Brown sees himself as a first-tier intellectual. He sees himself as a big brain and cultural leader and so forth in the United States, and in fact is mercilessly made fun of by his journalist colleagues for that. But, you know, you can see how he changes his fashions and eyeglasses and stuff like that to sort of get this image across. But anyway, I think that Brown, he does believe it, that this story about, the government doesn't lie, and also he doesn't believe it at the same time. In that sense, he's not so different from a lot of other people, including us, who can simultaneously believe two things that are false, that contradict one another, that can't both be true, but nevertheless carry out our lives from day to day believing those two things. It's very common. No, wait a minute.
And this is very important to... I'm sorry.
The phone lines are breaking up. Anyway, happening with Brown is that he's being forced into a confrontation with himself, with his own myths, so that he cannot say on the air, well, they didn't lie to us, and he cannot say on the air that they told us the truth and we believe them. So he comes up with this little kind of song and dance to bridge that by saying they came very close to blah, blah, blah. Well, they didn't just come close to it. I mean, look at the situation. It's quite straightforward. They specifically had a propaganda campaign that was designed to use CNN to carry a message. So that's what's happening with lots of journalists around the country, I think, in different ways.
I think it gets to the heart of the problem of contemporary journalism. Its claim to special status in the culture is that it is a watchdog on other centers of power. It's a monitor on those centers of power. Yet because of its close relationship, its cozy relationship with people in power, as Chris is pointing out, it can't simply say these people are lying to us because it destroys the illusion. So I think this is an interesting case where Aaron Brown, who is a quirky oddball in his own way, is exactly what Chris is saying. He's sort of narrating one of the central problems of journalism today.
You're tuned to 90.3 WZBC. The program is Sounds of Dissent. We're speaking on the line with Professor Robert Jensen, author of the article that appeared in Newsday a while ago, actually, Beware the Sources of Official Info, also journalism professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and Professor Christopher Simpson of Communication at the American University, and author of The Science of Coercion, among other books. Let me go back to the report from Fairness and Accuracy and reporting a bit. Well, actually, let me jump to a slightly different topic and ask you, Christopher Simpson, about how you see Fallujah having become a quote-unquote war zone, which would appear to allow war crimes like cutting off food and water supplies to civilians.
Sure. As Bob was pointing out earlier, the military and other government organizations, corporate organizations, become more and more sophisticated at this stuff. And in the particular case of Fallujah, there are a couple examples where the information operations, which is kind of the current slang for PSYOPs, the information operations played a very significant role in how this battle was carried out, and more specifically, in creating the circumstance where war crimes could be committed and yet denied at the same moment. And that's not so simple as just lying straight out. It's more subtle. And I'll give you an example. If an army is approaching a city, even by the U.S. military's own code of military justice, you can't simply start massacring civilians in that city. It's against the law. It's against the law of war. And that's what they put the Nazis on trial for, at least part of it. And there have been other trials along these same lines, the Milosevic trial and so forth, where the root of the accusation is that this military organization went to a civilian center and deliberately killed civilians who had no military role at all. And that sounds a lot like what is going on in Fallujah, frankly, at least part of what's going on. So how do they justify that even in their own terms? Well, the way it's done is you have the army basically, or the Marines in this case, rather, holding the city at siege, right? Nobody goes in, nobody goes out. Then they, using information operations, dropping leaflets, using loudspeakers, that sort of thing, they warn the people of the city that there's going to be a war there, that it is a, quote, war zone, unquote, and that if you don't want to be in a war, that if you fail to leave this war zone, then your life is at risk, then you have no rights, is essentially what it said. So in the military mind, What has happened is that they've told the civilian population that they must leave, and anybody who's left after this is fair game, is a target that can be killed without consequence and without hesitation. But what's the actual situation on the ground? The actual situation on the ground is you've got 100,000 people in this city, civilians, women, school teachers, nurses, kids that are 8 years old, you know, ordinary people, just like a city you live in. And it's surrounded by these foreign troops, all of whom are heavily armed. And so now they get a piece of paper from the sky that says you must leave. So what happens? Well, of course they don't leave. Why? To go leave and be taken prisoner and put in a concentration camp? Of course they don't leave. But from the military standpoint, they've been warned. Therefore, these people who were civilians, these eight-year-olds who were civilians, now are transformed into combatants, or believed to be, or argued to be combatants in the military legal mindset, which permits extraordinary types of violence, bombing, killing, indiscriminate killing. Most recent report in the British newspapers is the use of napalm. United Nations declared use of napalm as a war crime 25 years ago. They let the Americans off the hook for Vietnam, where napalm was institutionalized, but in 1980 declared it a war crime. International law, very well documented. Now, the Brits, their concern is as well, the Parliament is not as sort of a rubber stamp of Tony Blair as the U.S. Congress is of Bush. So they're calling on Blair to explain, are the British going to remain allied with the United States when they commit what is, according to British law, a war crime? Interesting question. So anyway, getting back to the Fallujah situation, you remember this war just it didn't come out of nowhere. There was a war in Fallujah, what, 6-8 months ago, something like that, 6 months ago, and which the Marines lost, and they were driven out. Why was it that they lost? Or part of the reason was, and this is their thinking now, was that the hospital, the doctors in the hospital in Fallujah, were giving news to international news agencies concerning the fact that they, doctors, were treating hundreds of civilians for a variety of war-related injuries, seriously injured people, lots of fatalities, and so on. And the international pressure on the United States grew so great that they reached a decision, rather than to fight the whole thing through, they backed out. All right.
We're speaking with Christopher Simpson, professor of communication at American University and author of a number of books, including The Science of Coercion. I'd like to ask Robert Jensen, journalism professor at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the book Writing Dissent. Robert Jensen, just in the context of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld having been asked to serve again in that capacity by President Bush just in the last day or so, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, one of his ingenious, one of the creations in the Pentagon during his time was the Office of Strategic Influence, the OSI, which the New York Times wrote in early 2002, was developing plans to provide news items, possibly even false ones, to foreign media organizations to influence public sentiment and policymakers in both friendly and unfriendly countries. The phenomenon of blowback is well known, where misinformation, disinformation, or black propaganda, as it's called, or gray propaganda in another country suddenly becomes exposed to United States citizens, who are then misled by it as well. What I'm wondering about is how, Robert Jensen, you see journalists in the United States historically handling the problem that the sort of inherent conflict in the philosophy of journalism, common philosophy, that objectivity is a goal of journalism, that it's possible to portray events in more or less one, from one objective perspective. And yet, we find some journalists, like CNN's Aaron Brown, not representing all the rest of U.S. journalists, but saying something like, there's an explicit bargain between the press and the Pentagon during war. Journalists don't do anything to endanger the troops or to endanger U.S. military operations. And in return, the Pentagon does not lie to journalists. That tacit agreement and United States journalists, in a sense, taking on roles, or at least their broadcast corporations taking on the roles of cheerleaders, of seeming to side with or to favor the U.S. government, instead of providing just objective news and information, regardless of how it may affect one side or another. How is this internal contradiction between objectivity and being a citizen of one country handled in journalism today? Robert Jensen.
Well, I think you're pointing to a very sort of a weak link in journalism, where they claim this status of neutral watchdogs on power, yet at the same time claim their allegiance to the United States or to any nation state. And of course, whatever one thinks of patriotism, it is a political position. So essentially what journalists are saying is completely, you know, incoherent. They are saying we're neutral except when we're not neutral, which is, you know, quite silly, but that's the way it works. I think something Chris said earlier is very important about the power that the Pentagon has to define the world, or we might say more accurately, the way in which journalists give the Pentagon the power to define the world. So when there was finally a refugee flow out of Fallujah, the U.S. Army allowed women and children to leave, but it blocked what they called military-aged males from leaving on the presumption that some number of them were resistance fighters and they didn't want them to escape. Well, that's a war crime. To bar civilians fleeing a war zone is a war crime. Now, what's interesting is that the government announced they were doing this, and the media reported it, but the media didn't go the further step to report that it was obviously a war crime, at least not the media in the U.S., not the mainstream media. So it's a funny situation where there's a combination of disinformation and journalistic self-censorship. And somehow the way that contemporary journalism defines objectivity, they're able to somehow manage all of this by defining appropriate information as that which comes from official sources, and, you know, dangerous and information about which we must be skeptical that comes from other sources. That's how they negotiate this whole objectivity. It's about what information is deemed credible, authoritative. And what that does, of course, is deliver journalism directly into the hands of powerful institutions, in this case the military, but as we've been pointing out, other arms of the state, and of course the corporate world as well. And it really, I think, is reaching a crisis point because so many people are aware that these routines of objectivity are producing a distinctly unobjective journalism. And I think within the next 10 years or so, journalism is going to have to come to terms with this. And I think it would be a very welcome development if social movements, if people, citizen movements, started to focus more on this in the context of other political work.
Let me switch.
You know, I think Bob's putting his finger on something interesting there. And I think that there is a direct relationship between the repressive character of the Bush administration, its emphasis on lying, its glorification of lying in its own interest, which I think, you know, nobody likes to say the word fascism, but I think, frankly, it's certainly a smell of fascism about that. I think that there's a direct relationship between that policy or those activities of the Bush administration and the crisis in confidence, a crisis of believability in terms of media organizations, the crisis of believability in terms of a lot of myths that kind of keep the economy turning over year after year, that those myths are breaking down. How fast they break down, I don't know. Exactly how it's going to wash out, I don't know that either. But they are breaking down. And I think that one thing that you see the Bush administration doing is turning to really a very aggressive and violent response to that situation under the name of fighting terrorism, of course, but that's how they're behaving. I think that if you grab a hold of that particular thread, there are a number of other things that fall into place.
Let me switch the topic just a little bit and ask you, as a concluding question, Christopher Simpson, about a new report that came out end of November from Professor Susan T. Fisk at Princeton University. Her psychology research group, a study published in New Scientist magazine November 25, essentially concluding that all human beings are capable of committing torture and other acts of great evil. That's the unhappy conclusion drawn from the analysis of 25,000 psychological studies involving 8 million participants, according to Susan Fisk and her colleagues at Princeton. She's partly referring to torture and abuse enacted by U.S. military personnel at the Abu Ghraib prison in 2003 and this year. And she's not excusing individuals' responsibility for making those decisions, but she's, in this research study, pointing out that the common human psychological needs for acceptance by a group, for recognition, for positive appreciation by a group, leave us all vulnerable to being manipulated into committing these acts of gross human rights violations, of torture. And some of the very low-ranking U.S. military personnel who actually physically conducted the torture at Abu Ghraib, although they, of course, must be held responsible for their actions, as all of us must, we have to also look at the fact that human beings behave in this manner. Normal human beings can be driven to behave in this manner, given sort of manipulation of behavior that leads people to be vulnerable to influenced by authority figures, influenced by peer pressure and other kinds of social interactions based on the understanding of psychologies of these individuals. And Susan Fiske says, if we do not understand the importance of social context and accept that almost anybody could commit acts of torture under certain circumstances, then we are setting ourselves up for, again, situations where Abu Ghraib atrocities will occur. Again, I'm just curious in your comment, Christopher Simpson, about this, having written your book Science of Coercion and studied psychological operations, particularly in light of Seymour Hersh's articles in the New Yorker earlier this year, revealing that the American intelligence community, specifically military intelligence, had formed under another office, under Donald Rumsfeld and another underling of his, a specific, separate, secret, parallel operation. Special access programs, they were called, to have a kind of parallel chain of command down to influence the military personnel all the way down the line to the lowest ranking officers actually conducting the torture, who would be still separate, in a separate hierarchy, and therefore unaccountable by name.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you've put your finger on a whole series of very important and very complicated questions. I think the one of the most basic there is it has to do with the humans' ability to make decisions for themselves, the extent to which we are free agents, if you will, in the sense of having both the ability and the drive to make decisions for ourselves. And I think that one of the big stories of the last two or three centuries has been trying to come to grips with that, especially in wartime, but in civilian life as well. It's no secret that people are influenced by peer pressure. You can just walk down the street and watch the fashions that people wear. It's clear that that happens. But what has happened during the last century has been, or one of the great breakthroughs, both socially and legally, during the last century, was holding not just the individual who committed a military war crime, in other words, the concentration camp guard, holding that person responsible, but holding the chain of command that created the system that grinds out concentration camp guards by the tens of thousands. And that is what the issue is here, at least as I see it. Torture, in a very real sense, is a learned activity. People don't just sort of automatically know how to torture somebody else. They don't automatically desire to. There are some sociopaths where that's the case, but most people know. It's something that is taught. Well, who teaches it? Who decides to teach it? In this particular scenario, you have a situation where the Secretary of Defense signs pieces of paper in which the explicit order is, if you can read English, is to use very coercive methods that don't leave scars. Right? Use any kind of coercion you can, but don't leave a scar for the press to take a picture of. That's the essence of Rumsfeld's order. And that's exactly what happened.
Christopher Simpson, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there just due to unfortunate time limitations. But thank you so much for joining us on Sounds of Dissent, Christopher Simpson.
And Bob.
And Robert Jensen, thank you so much for joining us from Texas.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Thank you, too.
Christopher Simpson joined us from England. He's professor of communication at American University and author of several books, including The Science of Coercion. Robert Jensen joined us from Texas. He's journalism professor at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the book Writing Dissent. You're tuned to Sounds of Dissent on WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM. My name's John Grebe. We bring you the program every Saturday from 11.